I next met with Dr. Ajay Gopal from the University of Washington in Seattle. And to begin, he presented a 52-year-old man from his practice.
He presented with fatigue. He was really not sure why he was so tired. He actually had a little bit of weight loss as well associated with that, and then eventually presented with a palpable inguinal lymph node, had this biopsied, found to be a grade 1-2 follicular, had a low proliferative rate, and was referred to me. We completed his staging with a PET CT scan, which showed some faint uptake in a couple of ribs. It wasn't really clear this was related to his lymphoma, but he had at least stage 3 disease, probably stage 4 if we counted those bone lesions. And because he was symptomatic, we discussed treatment options at that point, and we discussed the pros and cons of anthracycline-based therapy versus bendamustine rituximab. We reviewed the data from the STILL study and the BRIGHT study, and because he had a low-grade follicular lymphoma, we opted to go with bendamustine rituximab.
And where is he right now in his treatment?
So he completed 6 cycles, tolerated it well, counts recovered with each cycle nicely, which is certainly a point to remember when treating with bendamustine rituximab. And we could talk a little bit about some of the data from the gallium study and what that gave us a little bit of warning with that study. But his counts recovered nicely. We did a PET scan at the end. He was in a complete remission, and he's now just in follow-up.
And what happened to his symptoms?
Symptoms went away rapidly, just within a day or two of the first cycle.
And what about the lesions in the bone?
Lesions in the bone also normalized. Bone lesions sometimes can take a little bit of time to normalize, but they were FDG negative by the end of therapy.
Now, did he get rituximab maintenance?
He did not. You know, we talked a lot about maintenance pro versus con, and I would have to say, in general, I'm someone who probably doesn't use a whole lot of rituximab maintenance for follicular lymphoma, since there does not appear to be a clear survival advantage. For patients who have major complications from their underlying lymphoma and we're trying to delay that, then sometimes I will, but typically I don't use a tremendous amount of rituximab maintenance. For those where we do use rituximab maintenance, for people who are having frequent recurrent infections due to hypogammaglobulinemia, I have a low threshold to just stop rather than giving them immunoglobulin and rituximab maintenance. But it does take a conversation, and I think it's something we offer, or I certainly offer, but we discuss the risk versus benefit, pro-con.
And what about the option of rituximab alone? In what situations, if any, do you use that?
Well, I'll use it in patients that have low tumor burden. I didn't mention that this gentleman had high tumor burden based on the size and number of his lymph node sites. So low tumor burden patients will often use rituximab alone, patients with comorbidities. And frankly, there actually are patients who refuse chemotherapy and simply want to try rituximab even if they don't meet those criteria. So there are some patients who, even with high tumor burden, we might use rituximab based on patient preference.
So you referred to the ASH plenary presentation of the gallium study looking at obinutuzumab with bendamustine or chemotherapy up front. Could you talk about the design of that study, what the key findings were, and what you think it means?
So this was a randomized phase 3 trial comparing our chemo versus GA101 or obinutuzumab chemotherapy and frontline therapy for follicular lymphoma. And it's important to remember that obinutuzumab is dosed in a different way. So these patients on the obinutuzumab arm received an augmented induction. They received a gram of obinutuzumab on days 1, 8, and 15 with the first cycle as compared to the standard 375 per meter squared in the rituximab group. And then patients that were responding went on to receive maintenance therapy either with rituximab at the PRIMA schedule of 375 per meter squared every 2 months or every 2 months with a gram of obinutuzumab. So a lot more antibody in the obinutuzumab arm. So this study did show improved progression-free survival, primarily with the obinutuzumab arm as compared to the rituximab arm. However, you know, the take-home point, I think the big question that really hasn't been answered is it a better antibody or is it simply more antibody? And we do know that you can get higher response rates in certain settings by just giving more rituximab, and it has yet to translate into, with all the caveats of very short follow-up for a frontline follicular trial, translate into overall survival advantage. So I think the jury's still out as to whether this is, in the long run, a better regimen. There were more adverse events in the obinutuzumab arm than the rituximab arm. So, but very interesting data, and I think we'll really need mature follow-up to know whether this is going to be practice-changing.
You mentioned adverse events, and up until now, particularly with the experience in CLL, kind of the only thing I've really been hearing about with obinutuzumab is infusion reaction. Is that your take?
Certainly appears to have more infusion reactions than rituximab, absolutely. We are always on our toes when we have an obinutuzumab patient getting treated. So I think it's interesting, you know, the antibody was designed to engineer out the complement fixation, which was thought to reduce, the hope was to reduce the infusion reactions. And in fact, actually, there are more infusion reactions than with rituximab. So I think it really goes to show that, of course, we need the science to translate into the clinic, but until you test something in the clinic, you don't really know.
So if this man had presented now, after having seen these data, if you could access obinutuzumab, obviously it is approved. I don't know how easy or hard it might be to access it for a patient with FL up front, although it's approved, you know, later line. Would you have offered it as an option or discussed it as an option with him?
I probably would have discussed it with him. I think I probably would have erred more towards the bendamustine and rituximab, since we don't really have long enough follow-up to know if there are meaningful differences. We do know there are more adverse events with obinutuzumab, but certainly it would have been a discussion.
Any comments about the issue of subcutaneous rituximab? Are you utilizing that?
We're not utilizing that yet, but I think that's a fascinating strategy. Certainly could make it easier and simpler with less reaction. So that seems to be a direction that many of these antibodies are going, and hopefully that'll be something we can do. Rituximab, as with other antibodies, takes a long time to give, and this will free up patients' time as well as infusion room space.
Can you talk about your own approach to patients with relapsed follicular lymphoma? For example, if this man were to come in at some point with relapse disease, how do you generally think through options in relapse FL?
I usually think about, first, I think about what they originally were treated with and what the remission duration was. And I think sometimes the simplest questions give us the most important answers. And I quote the Casulo data, which I'm sure you've discussed extensively in your series here. And this series looking at patients who had early versus late relapse, those who relapsed after 2 years, after R-CHOP, where they looked at other regimens as well, those patients did really well. So usually in that situation, the key is restraint. We really try to not overdo it, to think that these are individuals who are going to have survivals very similar to age match controls, and we want to not hurt them, treat them when they need it, but not overdo it in terms of aggressiveness of therapy. So that's a general philosophy for really 4/5 of patients. Unfortunately, about 1/5 will relapse early, and I think for those who are young, like this gentleman that I discussed today, we don't really know what the right answer is, but we do know that more of the same is probably not the right answer. So these are patients where I will think about offering them novel agents on trials, considering stem cell transplants, CAR T cells, some other strategy than just more chemotherapy. So I think philosophically into these two broad categories and then take it from there.
What are some of the options in the relapse setting? And I'd like you to comment specifically on the issue of Del-Lesib. I know you've done a lot of research on that. Can you comment on what we've learned about that and other strategies in the relapse setting?
Yeah, so relapsed follicular lymphoma, the good thing is we have a lot of options. The challenging thing is choosing which option, and unfortunately, none of these really appear to be curative. These are palliative in terms of the standard options. So we can talk a little bit about idelalisib. There was a large single-arm phase 2 trial looking at patients with double refractory indolent lymphoma. Majority had follicular lymphoma. This means refractory to rituximab and refractory to an alkylating agent. Patients were treated with idelalisib, 150 milligrams POBID, continuous therapy until progressive disease. And this trial showed an overall 57% response rate in this double refractory patients. And duration of response, progression-free survival was all in the range of about 1 year. So this led to the approval of this agent and certainly does provide another option for patients in the double refractory setting, and it's actually approved for those with 2 prior therapies. Since that time, we've actually learned a lot more about idelalisib, and we've learned that this is probably not just directly cytotoxic to lymphoma cells, but also an immunomodulatory agent, and we have to be very careful about monitoring for both infections, such as pneumocystis and CMV reactivation, as well as closely monitoring early on for LFT abnormalities, and then particularly late for diarrhea and inflammatory diarrhea. So it can be used quite effectively, but one does have to not just think it's a simple pill and there will be no side effects. We do have to monitor patients.
Any more specifics about how people are visualizing the way this causes these kind of immune problems?
This is thought to be an inflammatory process. We do know, at least in laboratory models, that idelalisib will suppress Tregs and myeloid-derived suppressor cells. So there's actually a lot of excitement to combine this class of drug with other agents such as checkpoint inhibitors, so we may get the beneficial effect. But we do need to monitor patients. You see usually an inflammatory colitis, for example, and we can treat this with corticosteroids.
I've also heard it speculated that maybe patients who have had less treatment might have more problems, that as people are treated later line therapy, their immunity is sort of beat down a little bit.
Right. That's certainly an observation. Earlier in the disease course, we see more, particularly the hepatitis, the LFT abnormalities, than folks that have had more extensive prior therapy.
What are the clinical situations that you would use idelalisib in follicular lymphoma? And what about the issue of rituximab or not?
Well, you know, I use it in the setting of on-label patients that have had two prior therapies. Typically, these are folks that have had either R or R chemo, followed by another course of R or R chemo, and we have a discussion. Patients need to be able to be monitored. I think we can't simply write the prescription and say, come back in 6 months. So patients have to be compliant. They have to be individuals who will report their symptoms. If they're having diarrhea, we need to know about it. But I think this is certainly an option for patients, and even in young patients, as potentially a bridge to another therapy, to a more definitive therapy such as transplant.
I noticed that you had a couple of papers at the ASH meeting looking at R-CHOP and radioimmune therapy. Can you comment a little bit about that?
Yeah, so radioimmunotherapy, I mean, this is a modality that's approved for relapsed follicular lymphoma, ibrutinib, teoxetan. We often use just because it's a shorter word than saying yttrium-90, ibrutinib, teoxetan. The study that we reported at ASH was a long-term follow-up of the Southwest Oncology Group study comparing R-CHOP versus CHOP I-131 tocetumumab. That agent is very similar to the ibrutinib, teoxetan. It had been withdrawn because of really lack of people using it. And it was very interesting. The longest remissions were with the radioimmunotherapy. And I can tell you anecdotally in my clinic, patients that have received radioimmunotherapy, those are the folks that stay in remission. However, this was counterbalanced by a slightly higher rate of secondary malignancies in the radioimmunotherapy group. So the overall survival was really a wash. But it does tell us that this is a very powerful therapy. And I think people often forget about using radioimmunotherapy for their patients with follicular lymphoma.
Can you describe a situation right now or a recent case where you've used radioimmunotherapy with FL?
Well, the kind of situation really would be somebody who has had prior therapies. Usually, I'm a little more cautious in folks that are young because they have many years ahead of them and you want to keep the downstream options open. But for older adults, however one may want to define that, this is a very well-tolerated therapy. You can get long remissions, and there's less of a worry about secondary myeloid malignancies in 10 years, potentially, in this population.
And when you use radioimmunotherapy in that situation, what do you see globally? What percent of patients benefit?
Yeah, well, the data would say about half get a remission, and the remission duration on average from the studies is about a year. I think what's sometimes forgotten is there is a significant subset that really can get long remissions. And there, as was seen in the SWOG study as well, you know, probably 10, 20% can really have prolonged remissions with radioimmunotherapy. So there's some patients who are particularly sensitive to this strategy. You do have to make sure you do a marrow, and patients have to have less than 25% bone marrow involvement. But it's really very well tolerated, two infusions and you're done.
Let's move on now and talk about CLL, and let's hear about your case.
I have a patient that I'm seeing currently who is in his early 60s. He has a deletion 17p CLL. And we actually watched and waited him for probably 2.5 years. This is a high-risk CLL, but I think it's often forgotten that even if you have this P53 mutated or deletion 17P CLL, the indications for treatment are still the same. So we can still observe people for some period of time before we start treating them. So he had development of thrombocytopenia and worsening splenomegaly symptoms. So we discussed with him clinical trial options as well as standard approaches, and he was started on ibrutinib therapy. And I think this is, I think people really know this now, that with these patients with deletion 17P or P53 mutated, these are the patients that you absolutely use novel agent therapy. So he's responding, he has a partial response. He's been on therapy now for about 7 months. And, you know, he's still young. He's a young person. And the challenge now is, what do we do and how do we monitor? And I think this is an area of controversy, but we can now assay for development of resistance to BTK. So it's not clear whether intervening sooner actually changes the long-term outcome, but we can detect resistance to Bruton tyrosine kinase inhibitors before we see clinical resistance. And then the next approach would likely be something like venetoclax or a clinical trial.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that. Getting back to this man's initial, could you talk a little bit about what his status was when you started the ibrutinib? What was his white count and how much lymphadenopathy did he have?
He had fairly low volume lymphadenopathy. As I recall, his white count was, I believe, in around the 100,000 range. But the main indication for starting therapy was the fact that his splenomegaly was worsening. He was now symptomatic with that, and his platelets were dropping to the 90,000 range.
And what happened to his white count when you started the treatment?
Well, as expected, the white count went up, and usually takes about 6 months or so for it to come back down to close to the normal range. So we monitored him through this. His platelet count improved rather quickly, and he actually felt quite a bit better.
So any tolerability issues with him at all as he's been taking the ibrutinib?
No major ones. I think, you know, people do get easy bruisability. They note nail changes, hair changes, but for him at least have been more nuisance issues.
I haven't heard about hair changes.
I think hair and nails kind of go together. I actually had one gentleman who his gray hair went away and he got brown hair. So,
wow.
Back. So he was pretty excited about that. But people note more in the coarseness of the hair becomes kind of coarse.
Interesting. You know, the other issue, obviously, you mentioned the bleeding. Did he have, I've heard that people get sort of bruising on their arms, or what did he have?
He had that kind of thing. Basically, people, if they're carrying a shopping bag, they often note the next day they have some bruises or bruises on their legs where they didn't realize they bumped into things. So it's definitely easy bruisability. He's not fortunately had any major bleeding, but minor bruising is very common.
What about the issue that occasionally is seen of the patient who's already on anticoagulation, or maybe the patient has atrial fibrillation? How do you approach those patients? How would you have approached this patient if that was the case?
Yeah, I think this is a tough call. I think the original studies prohibited patients from being on warfarin concurrently. Now, does that mean that the risk-benefit of starting the therapy is to use an alternative agent? I think we don't know. But I usually try to have patients not on warfarin, or rather on an alternative anticoagulant. Maybe they would be on low molecular weight heparin or some other agent. Or you could consider trying to see if we can get something like venetoclax approved. I mean, for an individual patient, it's not approved for frontline therapy, but these are places where we try to make appeals for something like venetoclax. Of course, we'd offer clinical trials if they're available.
The other issue that comes up, you're basically development of atrial fibrillation. Have you had patients on ibrutinib who develop atrial fibrillation, require anticoagulation? What do you do in that situation?
Well, again, we weigh the risks and benefits. And I think for someone who has a high-risk CLL where there are other limited options, then we often will try to keep them on therapy and control their rate and anticoagulate them as safely as we can, or potentially anticoagulate them with aspirin if appropriate, rather than full anticoagulation. It really is an individualized situation. There are not a lot of great therapies or effective therapies approved for deletion 17P CLL, for example. So you basically have ibrutinib, venetoclax, idelalisib in the relapse setting also has activity with rituximab, but you're somewhat limited.
So the other issue about ibrutinib I hear people talking about relates to surgery, dental procedures. What advice or what do you do with your patients who are having that?
Usually we have them hold the drug, so 3 days for minor procedures and a week or more for major surgery. We do have them hold the drug.
And maybe we can move on now and talk a little bit about venetoclax, which conceivably might be in this man's future if he does develop progressive disease, obviously approved in the second line or after ibrutinib setting. First, I wanted to ask you, how often do you see a change in 17p status either way? And do you look for 17p in a patient who relapses who wasn't 17p at diagnosis?
Yeah, I usually do look. Anytime we're making a change in therapy, we usually look to see if there's been clonal evolution, because it certainly can help. Even if we had somebody who was not a deletion 17p and we treated them with, say, bendamustine rituximab or FCR or something like that, we usually will look to help guide our next decision.
Any estimates about how often you see somebody go from negative to positive?
Well, you know, that's a great question, and I don't have a great estimate other than anecdotes. I would have to look at the literature.
And in terms of using venetoclax, any comments about your own experience with the drug?
Most of the patients we've treated, actually, we treated on study, which had very specific requirements as to how you would manage and prophylax for tumor lysis syndrome. It's doable. I think you just have to prepare everybody for it and really follow the rules. It's very tempting to say, well, gosh, you know, you're probably okay. But there were some very unfortunate outcomes before we learned about how to deal with this as the drug was being developed. So I think you really just have to be careful and follow the recommended guidelines for tumor lysis prophylaxis.
Have you had any patients who fit into sort of the high risk category and required hospitalization? And what do you do when you hospitalize somebody?
We have. They actually were not my personal patients, but one of my colleagues here, and we put them in the hospital, and we monitor their labs for tumor lysis, and we give them prophylaxis with hydration and allopurinol, and we do the whole strategy to prevent tumor lysis.
And how long does it usually take? How long are they usually in the hospital?
They're usually just in the hospital for a few days.
I also like your comments about the issue of upfront therapy in a younger patient like this and the patient without DEL17P. I guess the big question there is, are you going to use something like FCR or BR versus ibrutinib? How do you think that through?
Yeah, so I think we have the data on the two ends of the spectrum. So we've got the patients with the highest risk disease with deletion 17P. We know we're going to use ibrutinib. And then we have patients with low risk disease that have mutated CLL with favorable cytogenetics. And those are the patients, especially young patients, who can get decade plus remission with FCR. So I think those are where we do have answers. And I think everybody else in between, it's a little more complicated. I guess what I try to describe to patients who understand this concept is sort of the area under the curve of side effects. Is it better to have something like ibrutinib, which you're continuously taking for years that should control the disease? Or is it better to have a short course of chemoimmunotherapy to try to control the disease and maybe have some years off therapy? And I have that discussion with patients about their various preferences. So I don't think there is a clear-cut right answer for those patients in the middle, but it does lead to a discussion about, is it better to use a novel agent continuously, or is it better to have a intermittent therapy of chemoimmunotherapy?
We were talking before about obinutuzumab and FL, and of course, it's obviously approved in CLL with chlorambucil. Could you talk about to what extent, if any, you utilize obinutuzumab in CLL?
Obinutuzumab, I use it for older patients in combination with chlorambucil as part of initial therapy, so I think that's a very reasonable option. My experience is that in patients with bulky disease, we're really relying primarily on the antibody. It doesn't have quite as much efficacy as, say, bendamustine rituximab on bulky disease as we would hope. So certainly folks with non-bulky CLL, older patients with comorbidities, it's a very reasonable option.
And we were talking about the infusion reaction. What do you see when you use it in CLL in that situation with older patients?
It's real. You have to be careful. I recently had someone that had an MI during their obinutuzumab infusion. So I think you do have to be careful. And it comes into the equation of whether it's better to deal with the infusion reaction or better to, say, just give bendamustine rituximab.
So you were talking before about something I never heard about, this idea of looking for resistance to BTK inhibitors. I'm curious what your thoughts are about other BTK inhibitors. The one I've heard about is acalabrutinib, and what potential advantages it poses both in terms of efficacy and tolerability.
I think the main advantage appears that it may be more tolerable. I think we certainly don't have a head-to-head comparison data to know that, and it's really speculative at this point, but the early data suggests it might be more tolerable, and I think that might be a potential advantage, but it really remains to be seen. There are lots of BTK inhibitors out there that are being developed in addition to acalabrutinib.
You also were talking about adalimumab related to follicular lymphoma. What about adalimumab you mentioned with CLL? Where do you usually fit it in the sequence of things?
Usually not first line. So in patients that have relapsed or refractory disease, particularly those that have either complex cytogenetics or deletion 17p and prior to venetoclax, it would be something we would consider after ibrutinib. But now we would probably go to venetoclax first.
When you were talking before about acalabrutinib maybe being more tolerable, with respect to what specific issues?
It appears to be less bleeding is my take on the literature.
Interesting. Also, in terms of other agents, again, we were talking about adalimumab. What about other PI3 kinase inhibitors? And again, the one I've heard about is capanlisib.
Right. So this is interesting. This is an intravenous PI3K, and these data were recently presented. And in terms of efficacy, it looks on par with idelalisib, and at least with all the caveats of cross-study comparisons, it may have a better tolerability than idelalisib, but I think, you know, it's very hard to make these comparisons across studies. It is IV, which may be advantageous in some situations.
Are pretty much all the downside of these agents these sort of immune reactions, or do you see other more direct, you know, side effects and toxicities?
Well, there are other side effects. I mean, it is somewhat myelosuppressive. Pretty much every study with a PI3K inhibitor does show some myelosuppression. There are a lot of sort of general fatigue and other constitutional symptoms that have been really seen with all drugs that are targeting the whole B-cell receptor signaling pathway. So we focus on these higher grade or somewhat unique type toxicities, but there are these general toxicities that we see. And I think this, when it comes back to counseling patients in your CLL example, is it better to have 6 months of bendamustine rituximab toxicity and hopefully be off for a number of years? Or is it better to have these low-grade type toxicities, but they're continuous?
Incidentally, that concept of trying to sort of throw somebody into an unmaintained remission, is that also what you're thinking when you give like chlorambucil or obinutuzumab?
Ideally, we would give people time off. You're right. We would treat them and we could give them some time off therapy.
So let's talk a little bit about diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And I'm really curious about your 66-year-old man.
Well, you know, I think this gentleman really illustrates the big challenge we have in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. I think it's a challenge that we've created for ourselves because we are curing so many more people up front. And those that we don't cure, it's a real tough situation. So this gentleman had advanced stage disease, ABC subtype by immunohistochemistry, so we know that's a higher risk situation. He received 6 cycles of R-CHOP and initially clinically responded, had reduction in symptoms and adenopathy, but unfortunately by the end had disease progression. We then followed the standard algorithm and said, okay, well, let's try platinum-based salvage. He's otherwise healthy, but unfortunately he had progressive disease at that point, even after platinum-based salvage chemotherapy. So he was now quite symptomatic, and this is the patient where you offer clinical trial. So he was eligible for a CAR T-cell trial. He had very bulky, rapidly progressive disease, and unfortunately only had a transient disease control with CAR T-cells. And now we are in the situation where we are trying to come up with options for him.
Oh, interesting. When I saw CAR T, I was expecting you're going to tell me he had this fantastic response and, you know, cytokine release syndrome. Have you had other patients treated with CAR T with diffuse large B-cell or any other cancer for that matter?
Yeah, oh yes. We have seen dramatic responses. You know, I think at least my anecdotal observations are that lymphomas that respond to CAR T-cells are similar to lymphomas that respond to therapies to some degree. We've had better results in the indolent lymphomas than the DLBCLs. Certainly the refractory DLBCLs, it's a challenge. And maybe there's just too much tumor burden to overcome and too much highly kinetic tumor to overcome by the CAR T-cells. But we certainly have had patients with long remissions that have received CAR T-cells, no doubt.
Any experience with cytokine release syndrome or neurotoxicity?
It's real, and it has to be addressed early. This is not something to be taken lightly. Anytime a patient gets their first fever after CAR T cells, they're essentially put in the hospital and monitored closely. And if patients need to be treated with tocilizumab or other therapies, we really have a very low threshold for doing that. It's interesting, some patients really have very little and get a good response, and others have quite a bit, and it can manifest in many different ways. But clearly, CNS toxicity is something you have to monitor for very closely.
Is the thinking that the CNS toxicity is some variation related to cytokines?
Patients can't have focal signs, so you can't have focal neurological findings.
Any other comments about diffuse large B-cell and where things are heading? I noticed that he has a ABC subtype. I know it's looking at lenalidomide, I think ibrutinib in these patients. Any situations where you would consider those strategies outside a trial setting?
Yeah, I mean, we think of using those when we're really somewhat running out of options. Both lenalidomide and ibrutinib do have a small but meaningful response rate. Unfortunately, the duration of remission and progression-free survival is really measured just in a matter of months. Where I think we're most excited about looking at those agents is in the upfront setting, and there are two large prospective randomized trials looking at lenalidomide plus R-CHOP and ibrutinib plus R-CHOP in ABC subtype DLBCL.
Let's move on and talk about mantle cell lymphoma, and maybe you can talk about your 60-year-old man, maybe just kind of summarize the earlier therapy he had, and we can focus on what happened when he had relapse disease.
This was someone who we treated a number of years ago who had advanced stage disease. We treated him with R-CHOP as induction, and based on the original European mantle cell data, we consolidated him with high-dose therapy and autotransplant. As I recall, I think he only had a partial remission to R-CHOP, which did not bode well. He then received one cycle of rice prior to transplant and still had marrow-positive disease and had an autotransplant. And at that point in time, we didn't know that rituximab maintenance was beneficial. Did not receive rituximab maintenance, but went on a study with vorinostatin bortezomib maintenance, but unfortunately had a relapse 2 years after autotransplant. At that point, I believe we treated him with ibrutinib therapy, and he had a nice response. Symptoms were controlled, lymphadenopathy improved. Unfortunately, by about 8 months, as I recall, after initiating therapy, he had progressive disease, which was rapidly progressive, and unfortunately succumbed to his mantle cell lymphoma at that point.
So can you talk about right now what your current approach is to upfront therapy of mantle cell, both in younger and older patients, and where maintenance fits in?
So for younger patients, we will offer intensified induction therapy with high-dose therapy and autotransplant. We will clearly explain to patients that it's not clear that this improves overall survival, but it clearly improves progression-free survival, and it can give them a prolonged period of time off therapy. So if they want to be aggressive, then we will offer them intensified induction, usually with some sort of high-dose cytarabine component as part of the induction therapy. Our current in-house regimen is using the VR-CAP alternating with rituximab, high-dose ARC, and then followed by high-dose therapy with autotransplant.
That's interesting, though. You use the VR, that's with bortezomib, right?
That's right. So that's based on the randomized trial comparing R-CHOP versus VR-CAP, showing an advantage to VR-CAP. So we are off-study incorporating that into our induction regimen prior to autotransplant.
And what about maintenance in these patients?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So maintenance rituximab has not shown a survival advantage in most B-cell lymphomas, an overall survival advantage. However, in mantle cell, this is the one setting, both in the upfront setting after R-CHOP, the subset analysis of the European mantle cell trial, which did show a survival advantage to rituximab maintenance, and the Lima prospective trial, as well as the retrospective data from our center, also showed a survival advantage when used after autotransplant. So we do use rituximab maintenance after autotransplant for mantle cell lymphoma because of an overall survival advantage and after R-CHOP induction.
And what about your older patients?
Yeah, so older patients, it's a little tougher. I think the older is also in the eye of the beholder a little bit. So we don't have a magic number of 60 or 65 for autotransplant. We still will discuss with patients who are fit and want to be aggressive. But frequently, we will off-study use something like bendamustine rituximab very well tolerated, works well, appears to be superior to R-CHOP, at least based on the STILL study. So this is typically our strategy.
And what about maintenance there?
Yeah, so the maintenance therapy after bendamustine rituximab did not seem to improve outcomes, which was kind of interesting. So I guess one could extrapolate from the R-CHOP data, but even in that study, the other arms did not show a benefit to rituximab maintenance. So typically we limit it to R-CHOP or after autotransplant.
And what about in the relapse setting? This man unfortunately seemed to go downhill after getting ibrutinib, but there are two other agents approved, lenalidomide and bortezomib. How do you integrate these modalities and also venetoclax, we were talking about before, into the therapy of relapse disease?
Yeah, you know, I think these are all on the list. I think what we have learned about ibrutinib is that when somebody has progressive disease on ibrutinib, it's sort of like the car is starting to roll, and when you stop the ibrutinib, you take your foot all the way off the brake. So we will often add therapies on top of ibrutinib in those situations rather than just stopping, which we have learned by experiences such as this. The proper sequence of these agents, I think we don't know. I tend to reserve ibrutinib for later in the disease course, but I think we really don't know what the proper approach is. This patient also could have had bendamustine at that point because he hadn't had that either. So for those who have long remissions after cytotoxic chemotherapy, you can also consider chemo again.
So another issue in mantle cell I want to ask you about is I see, interestingly, you've been involved with work looking at androgen receptor expression, something I've never heard about in mantle cell. What do we know about this?
Well, this is one of the things that we do in academia is we get to ask a little bit of these left field questions. One thing that we don't really understand is why mantle cell lymphoma is predominantly male. And it's not just 55% male like other lymphomas. Many series is 80% male. So we don't really understand why it's mostly men who get mantle cell lymphoma. Years ago, I had a patient who had mantle cell lymphoma and prostate cancer, and he was treated with androgen ablation for his prostate cancer, and his mantle cell lymphoma just became quite quiescent and didn't really get a remission, but wasn't explosively growing. So light bulb turned on, and we went back and looked in the lab to see if androgen receptor was expressed in mantle cell lymphoma lines and in patient samples, and lo and behold, it actually was expressed more significantly in mantle cell lines and other B-cell lymphoma lines, and we could actually block the proliferation of those cells with enzalutamide. So we then proposed to the NCCN to fund a clinical trial. We are now evaluating the use of enzalutamide blocking androgen in patients with relapsed or refractory, and actually is open to untreated mantle cell lymphoma patients who may not be candidates for chemotherapy. So, you know, I think this is likely a long shot, but it's really translating some of what we observed in the laboratory into the clinic and hoping we can see some clinical activity.
How many patients have been treated so far?
We have treated, I believe, about 6 patients on study.
Any responses?
We've had some prolonged stable disease. I think the challenge we face with any mantle cell lymphoma study now is that many folks are coming with ibrutinib-resistant disease, and that is a really tough clinical situation where even multi-agent chemotherapy is ineffective.
You know, I've also seen this discussed androgen receptor levels in breast cancer, triple-negative breast cancer. And I don't know that that actually is going to be moving forward. They were looking at enzalutamide, also bicalutamide. Do you know how the levels there in breast cancer compare to what you saw with mantle cell?
I will concede I'm not a breast cancer expert. We compared it to prostate, where we saw very high, not surprisingly, very high levels. So they were not on par with prostate cancer, but they were clearly higher than other B-cell lymphoma lines.
So let's talk a little bit about Hodgkin lymphoma, and let's start with your 27-year-old woman.
Sure. So this is a wonderful young woman who had a bulky stage 2 Hodgkin lymphoma. She was treated locally, but with ABVD times 6 cycles, followed by involved field radiation therapy. And as I recall, I think she did well for about a year, and then had recurrence of her disease with palpable adenopathy, I believe, outside the radiation field. She was then reinduced with ICE chemotherapy and achieved a CR, and she really should be one of those patients that are in the PET negative group who have about a 70% chance of hopefully being cured with high-dose therapy and autotransplant. So she went on to transplant. She was treated on an investigational transplant regimen, did well with a tandem autotransplant, remained in remission, but unfortunately, again, a year later, had recurrence of her Hodgkin lymphoma. She then came to my clinic, and we treated her with brentuximab. Actually, at that point, it was on study, only available on study. She tolerated it well. She had a CR after, I believe, her second or fourth cycle, negative PET scan, and finished the full 16 doses over the course of a year. And now I have the pleasure to see her 5 years later, off treatment for about 4 years, and has not had any recurrence of her disease.
While she was treated, did she have any neuropathy?
She had some very slight numbness in her fingertips, but it did not progress beyond grade one.
So maybe you could comment a little bit about this phenomenon. I know that you've published on it, and I'm not sure everybody's really tuned into it, which is these patients who get CRs that are very prolonged from brentuximab vedotin with Hodgkin lymphoma.
Yeah, so about a third of the patients will get a CR, at least based on the pivotal trial. And really, the CRs are the only group that will have prolonged remission durations. Partial responses tend to not last very long, not that different than patients who didn't respond. And the CRs tend to occur early. So usually by cycle four or so, most people will have gotten a CR if they're going to get a CR. So you kind of know early whether they're going to be a CR patient. And what was interesting and really very unexpected was about a third of those who got a CR remain in CR now up to about 5 years median follow-up. So there's probably a small proportion of patients, and maybe this is still a little much of an overstatement, but that we hope are being cured by brentuximab alone, which has certainly led to moving this further forward in the disease course. And we are eagerly awaiting the readout of the ABVD versus the so-called AAVD, so brentuximab vedotin instead of bleomycin, frontline randomized phase 3 trial. And if we can take that 10 or 12% increased maybe cure rate at the tail end and add that to the front end and cure more people up front. So we're eagerly awaiting this data.
I was asking you before about neuropathy, but globally, what's your experience and what does the literature say about the neuropathy that's seen? When does it occur? What is the typical symptomatology and is it reversible?
The neuropathy can really occur at any point, and I think one really has to monitor this closely. What's a little different is there can be motor neuropathy, and we learned early on that even slight complaints about patients noting they caught their toe on the curb or on a step can be the first signs of motor neuropathy, signs of foot drop, and you really have to ask these questions when you see patients in clinic. The vast majority of patients did have complete reversal or significant improvement of their neuropathy. However, many will still notice a little bit of symptoms even years after receiving brentuximab. So I think like other drugs, you can have some persistent neuropathy. The main point is to monitor closely and really take a good history every time you see a patient that's getting a dose of brentuximab.
Could you talk about the strategy of post-transplant consolidation with B-vedotin, the big Athera trial that looked at that, and how you apply that to your practice?
Right. So this was a randomized phase 3 trial looking at patients with high-risk Hodgkin lymphoma, and they were randomized to either receive brentuximab maintenance after autotransplant or nothing, or observation. And this trial did show a significant improvement in progression-free survival. And not surprisingly, the greatest benefit was seen in the group of patients that had the greatest risk disease. So anytime a patient meets the criteria for high-risk disease, I will certainly counsel them to say, well, this is an option. This is something we could offer to you. We do know it would, on the whole, improve your progression-free survival. It's not clear it's going to improve the overall survival. But the ones where I really target this are those that had PET-positive disease, FDG-avid disease, going into autotransplant. We know from a variety of series, mostly data from Sloan Kettering, showing that this is a really high-risk group of patients, and those are the ones where they're going to have the most potential benefit.
So another development that's been really exciting in Hodgkin lymphoma has been the evolution of checkpoint inhibitors. Can you talk about what we know about that in HL and right now how, again, that gets integrated into your practice?
Yeah, so this is really the prototypic disease for the use of checkpoint inhibitors. Only about 1% of the cells in a Hodgkin lymph node are actually tumor cells. The rest is really a reactive inflammatory infiltrate that is impeded from eradicating the malignancy. So both pembrolizumab and nivolumab have shown high activity in relapsed or refractory classical Hodgkin lymphoma. And they're both approved with slightly different labels for the use in classical Hodgkin lymphoma. I think the question comes as to when one should use it. I think it's sort of a no-brainer when you're running out of other options that this is a very reasonable thing to do for folks that have had recurrent disease after brentuximab vedotin, for example. The questions that are being asked are, should this be used prior to brentuximab? Should it be used earlier in the disease course? Should you use it prior to an allogeneic transplant, or should you use it instead of an allogeneic transplant? And then what are the risks in these situations? And this is obviously a much larger discussion where really there are more questions than answers, but it does offer another opportunity to our patients to further improve their remission durations and hopefully survival.
Any personal observations in your own experience in terms of efficacy of checkpoint inhibitors, any patients that stand out, as well as tolerability and autoimmune toxicities?
Yeah, I've seen both in my patient population. These can really be pretty miraculous therapies for folks that have highly chemo-refractory disease and have progressive disease after brentuximab. These agents can induce remissions, but likewise, we do have to monitor. We need to follow the thyroid function, for example, to look for hypophysitis. And there have been reported cases of things like myocarditis, so we need to listen to patients' symptoms. But they're actually really quite well tolerated for the most part and can work when other therapies have failed.
Any unusual autoimmune complications you've observed in your patient? Have you seen pneumonitis? Because I know that's a little bit of a concern with these patients.
Yeah, I personally, fortunately, have not had a patient with pneumonitis, but certainly is something that we monitor. If patients come in with cough or pulmonary symptoms, we will investigate further, have a low threshold for imaging or pulmonary function tests or pulmonary referral. Actually, my solid tumor colleagues are much more experienced with the use of checkpoint inhibitors. The heme malignancy docs like myself are kind of late to the game here, and I will often turn to my solid tumor colleagues and say, give me some suggestions about how to manage, and I suspect my community colleagues are actually much more adept at using checkpoint inhibitors than a lymphoma doc like myself.
Yeah, well, coming into non-small cell lung cancer, I mean, it gets frequently used there for sure, and melanoma, et cetera, of course. What about the issue of the older patient with HL? Of course, we know most patients are younger, but there are people who are older, some not really candidates for chemotherapy. You have two sort of non-chemotherapy alternatives and checkpoint inhibitors. Bevacizumab, I guess, technically is chemotherapy. Have you had patients like that, and how do you approach that? And what about the combination of bevacizumab and a checkpoint inhibitor?
So I think one thing we've learned regarding older adults' frontline therapy for Hodgkin lymphoma is that bleomycin is not well tolerated. So for any patient over 60 or 65, I will typically just drop the bleomycin. We'll not use bleomycin in that patient population. So I think that's one thing that we've learned. And then the question is this someone who you can treat with curative intent with an anthracycline-based therapy cautiously, or is this someone who you really don't think can tolerate AVD, for example? So there actually are many patients who can tolerate AVD, and I wouldn't just based on somebody's age alone say we're not going to treat you with curative intent. So if it truly is someone who's very elderly or has comorbidities, then we think about things like single agent brentuximab vedotin. There's a series published, about 60% of the patients responded and achieved a complete remission. And the remission durations were not what we would expect with AVD or certainly ABVD, but it is a reasonable palliative strategy to use. Single agent gemcitabine also works quite well for palliation. We can use other single agent chemotherapeutic regimens. Frontline therapy with a checkpoint inhibitor and brentuximab is being investigated. There are data showing that in the relapse setting, there may be some synergy between brentuximab vedotin and checkpoint inhibitors. This was looked at specifically with nivolumab, and it's being evaluated in the upfront setting. I probably wouldn't do that off study, even in an older patient, but one might use those agents sequentially when they're needed.
I want to ask you a little bit about T-cell lymphoma and the way you typically approach patients with peripheral T-cell not otherwise specified.
Yeah, so what we do know, this is a high-risk disease, but simply giving CHOP is probably not the right answer. I think we've learned that. So often we'll think of intensified regimens like CHOEP, adding etoposide, or even EPOC, dose-adjusted EPOC, as an intensified induction for patients that can tolerate it. And then I think the big next question is, what's the advantage of consolidating with high-dose therapy and autotransplant? And this is where you're going to get lots of opinions. And there's certainly controversy, and it becomes a discussion again with patients whether or not you want to do that for patients that get a first remission. There are a number of studies looking at adding something to CHOP-like regimens or CHOEP-like regimens, some of the many new agents that have come out for treatment of T-cell lymphomas.
And of course, a lot of them are being used in relapse disease. And I am curious, the way you sequence therapy and relapse disease, do you test these patients through CD30 and use bevacizumab? What about romidepsin, pralatrexate, belinostat?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think these are all palliative therapies. I would look for CD30 early. Brentuximab is very potent therapy for patients that do have CD30 expression. And really, these become sequential palliative therapies, except for patients who you're using them as a bridge to something like an allogeneic transplant. So in those patients, if you can get a remission, we will often move them to allotransplant. But it often depends really on toxicity profile and individual patient preference.
This concludes our program, and we should note that subsequent to recording this discussion, copanlisib was granted accelerated approval for patients with relapsed follicular lymphoma who've received at least two prior systemic therapies. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Lymphoma and Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia Update.